Hello and welcome everyone here in the main auditorium and those of you downstairs in the overflow room to the forum's 40th anniversary lecture. My name is Jim Peck Gray and I'm the president of the forum, and I'm glad to see that so many of you braved the November slush to come out tonight. And now I'd like to present tonight's guest, a man who, as the cliche goes, needs little introduction. Reverend Jackson's leadership may well be unparalleled in American civil rights and politics. He's also a major force in international relations and foreign policy issues. But more than this, he has inspired many Americans of all races and all ideologies to become involved in the political process. He has shown and continues to show that active involvement in the issues that truly matter to people can and does make a difference. We are very fortunate to have him here with us tonight, and it is a great personal pleasure that I present to you the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Thank you very much. I assure you that your applause has the impact of intimidation as opposed to insurance. And assurance, I've heard so much about this great hall of enlightenment and intimidation. So now here I stand in the lion's den. Let me express my thanks to you for the invitation, for the chance to share with you on this occasion in this very pregnant moment in American history where so many critical decisions must be made in a relatively short period of time to determine the course of our nation, to perhaps determine the course of the destiny of this world, the rest of this century and on into the next century. Tonight I want to talk about, beyond changing parties, the challenge to change directions. There is another way. Just earlier this day we were in Detroit, met with workers of UAW, met with elected officials who were bemoaning the fact that General Motors intends to lay off 30,000 workers and close 5 plants in the next 12 months. 8,000 workers in Detroit, 7,000 Saginaw and Flint and St. Louis. And while that multinational giant reserves the right to disrupt those 30,000 workers and about 75,000 in the rippling effect of such a layoff, 2,500 workers at the Port Elizabeth plant in South Africa at General Motors are likewise in a stage of protest, playing their sham of withdrawal from South Africa. They have simply shifted their franchise to a smaller group of Afrikaners who have even less accountability than did General Motors with the Sullivan principles. They will not even, in their shift of power to the Afrikaners, make provisions for black workers in South Africa to have 2 slots on the board of directors, and subject those who would protest to the lion's paw in South Africa. They have not pulled out, they have sold out. They're still operating using a subcompact car to maintain their 9% of the South African market and expand their investments in South Africa. In fact, if they made an arrangement to shift power to blacks within South Africa and were to relocate their plants to Zimbabwe or Zambia or Tanzania and thereby be a factor in the development of the alternative trade routes out of South Africa through Mozambique or through Angola, it would make a difference in the region. So in some real sense, we see a multinational giant with one of its tentacles inside the U.S., subject to weak laws, but with tentacles beyond the U.S., operating beyond the Constitution as a force for economic tyranny in the world. Not too long ago, a generation could consider its work great and noble and significant if it did courageous things like refuse to go to the back of a bus and join the Freedom Rides from Nashville, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi. Or things like march for the right to vote, a march for open housing. But your generation must assume its role of leadership and responsibility in the world community. There is a danger tonight of our nation becoming victimized by protracted isolation, reinforced by arrogance and insensitivity. When Mr. Reagan and Mr. Gorbachev met, it was set the stage, the media of the world, but it was a minority meeting. Mr. Reagan and Gorbachev combined represent a half billion people. Rajiv Gandhi from India alone represents 100 million more human beings than Mr. Reagan and Mr. Gorbachev. One half of all human beings are Asian, 2 billion people, and half of them are Chinese. There are 22 nations in the Middle East, a half billion people in Africa, one-eighth of the human race. Our neighbors of the South and South, Central and Latin America speak Spanish and Portuguese in the main, their neighbors, African descendants in the Caribbean. Most people in the world are yellow, are brown, are black, poor, non-Christian, and don't speak English. It is in that world that we must assume our responsibility for leadership and membership in tomorrow's world. And thus, as we have grown stronger in power, a military and economic power, it has been, by and large, in these last 6 years with arrogance rather than grace. Just this past week, there was a major referendum. The referendum on Reaganism and Reaganomics that the president wanted, he got. The Reagan counter-revolution is potentially over. The Reagan roller coaster has mounting casualties. A host of converging negative interests combined to defeat him. The people may like the salesman, but the products are too expensive and too dangerous. The president still has his coat, but his coattails have been clipped and looking more and more like a waiter's jacket every day. The president won a referendum on Reaganism and Reaganomics, and the result was that progressives and liberals were elected in South Dakota, North Dakota, Colorado, Georgia, and Maryland, and returned to office in California, Connecticut, and elsewhere. The African-American vote played a critical role. The election reflected a continuing increase in voter registration, participation, turnout, and sophistication. The election resulted in 4 new African-American congresspeople and a net increase of 3 House seats. Mike Espy replaced Webb Franklin in Mississippi, John Lewis White Fowler in Georgia, Reverend Flake Adabo in New York, Kwesi Mfumi, Taryn Mitchell in Baltimore, Maryland. It played a key role in key Senate races. For example, in 9 key states, Alabama, Arkansas, California, Georgia, Florida, Louisiana, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, the black vote was a deciding factor or a significant influence in the Democratic recapture of the Senate. The total vote in these 9 states was 9,443,000, of which 2,800,000, or 30%, was black. The following is an analysis of 5 key southern states that, if subtracted from the Democratic victory, would make the Senate count 50-50, with Vice President Bush casting the deciding vote on all issues, including all chairmanships and committees. In effect, without these 5 states, Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, North Carolina, and Florida, there would not have been a Democratic victory. In Georgia, Senator Mark Mattingly was facing White Fowler. Mattingly received 594,012 votes. White Fowler received 615,050 votes. His margin of victory was 22,000 votes. 220,000 blacks went to the polls that day. 91.6, or 200,000, voted for White Fowler. In Alabama, Jeremiah Denton was facing Richard Shelby, Democrat. Mr. Denton received 591,085 votes. Was defeated by Mr. Shelby, who received 600,098 votes. 250,000 blacks went to the voting booth that day in Alabama. 90% voted for Mr. Shelby. In Louisiana, Senator Henson Moore was facing John Brough, Democrat. Mr. Moore received 645,176 votes. Defeated by Mr. Brough, received 722,847 votes. Mr. Brough's margin of victory exceeded 77,000 odd votes. 198,000 blacks went to the polls. 90% voted for Mr. Brough. North Carolina, James Broyhill was facing former Governor Terry Sanford. Mr. Broyhill, 757,668 votes. Defeated by Mr. Sanford with 817,000 votes. 236,000 blacks went to the polls, 86% for Mr. Sanford. The result was that this recently freed or enfranchised vote was a major factor in the Progressive Coalition redirecting the course of power in the House and Senate, and thus in our nation. The real significance of these votes and the debate about the role that I may very well play in 1988 is that the Rainbow Coalition's agenda is now a factor in the national equation to help determine the course and direction of our nation. The African American vote does not stand alone. Its isolation is exaggerated. We're just people, like everybody else. The election shows that progressives in coalition can win anywhere, in the North, in the East, in the West, in the South. They won in farm states and urban states, and states with a mixture of both. Progressive candidates can win in the South. Bobby Mikulski in Maryland, White Fowler in Georgia, 100% black caucus voting record, is now senator from Georgia. Terry Sanford with a good civil rights record in North Carolina, in Jesse Ham's country, won. The new mix of voters in the South will make the South a proving ground for economic justice in 1988. the candidates go south in 1988. There will be no governor standing in the schoolhouse doors. There will be no dogs biting children. Rather, they will find plants closed on workers without notice. Toxic waste dumps. Poor people with little education and poor health care. Workers forced to take wage concessions and high unemployment. Issues that affect more whites than blacks. Issues that cut across lines of race, sex, and national origin. The same mentality that was reluctant to grant civil rights in the U.S. is even more reluctant to grant independence and sovereign rights to African nations. The central issue is not sex, manhood or womanhood. It's not race, black or white. It's not even economic, rich and poor. It's mental and psychological. So at one level, the central issue is the mind. Who has the superior idea? Who can control the agenda of what does or does not get discussed? At another level, the central issue is converging interests. The African-American vote is not an aberration, an enigma. We're like other people who are hurting. We do like other people. We vote our interests. Why was Reaganism or Rambo in foreign policy rejected? Why was Reaganomics or his domestic policies rejected in the Senate elections last week? It was not in farmers' interest to vote for a farm policy that wasn't working and an administration that had no mercy on the family farmer. It was not in the workers' interest to support policies that have forced them to take wage cuts or lose their jobs and is giving them less purchasing power and a lower standard of living. They may like Rambo, but they cannot afford him. It was not in the interest of organized labor to support an administration whose words, policies, and programs are openly designed to bust them. It was not in the interest of African Americans, Latino Americans, and Asian Americans to support policies that are hostile to civil rights. Women had no interest in supporting an administration that is against the Equal Economic Rights Amendment. What American can support a foreign policy that is not coherent? It's not in our long-term national interest, articulated by a president who seems not to know or understand his own policies sometimes. The president was apparently ignorant and did not understand the difference between strategic and ballistic missiles in Iceland, and it caused a lot of confusion. On Libya, he apparently did not understand, but did not want the American press and people to understand, so he engaged in a policy of disinformation. That's a Harvard word, and my neighborhood is known as lying. Then a cargo plane was shot down over Nicaragua, and an American, Rambo Hossifus, was captured and put on trial. The White House denied that it had anything to do with it. It was traced directly to the White House. Then there was a Danilov affair. We swapped Danilov for a Soviet spy. The White House said no deal. No quid pro quo was involved. That's a lie. I mean disinformation. Now we've got Iran. For the president circumvented his own Secretary of State, as well as the Congress, to sell weapons privately to a country that we condemn politically as a hostage-taking terrorist nation. That deal with Iran further jeopardizes all Americans in the region and makes American hostages a premium. It endangers the lives of those who are there because it raises the worth of hostages to nations in that region. The president says the difference between Nicaragua and South Africa He said, Nicaragua goes beyond its borders, and South Africa does not. He says this despite the fact that South Africa, for more than a decade, has illegally occupied Namibia, has troops and surrogates in Angola and other frontline states, has destroyed more than $10 billion in infrastructure, railroads and ports in the frontline states as well. South Africa is deeply implicated in the death of Samora Machel, former head of state of Mozambique. Is this ignorance or disinformation on the part of President Reagan? The referendum and repudiation on the president's policies that took place on November 4th was a result of arrogance of power having caught up with him. In foreign policy, there was more bluster than security. After 6 years of rhetoric, name-calling, and military spending, the Soviet submarines are closer and we're less secure. We're not unaware of the great and important issues of our day. A $220 billion budget deficit, a $2.3 trillion debt, a $170 billion trade deficit, and the threat to the world economy of the international debt crisis among the developing nations of the world. But those numbers are too abstract and almost beyond comprehension by the average person. Most common people know that life is just tougher. Average people know that they are just one sickness away from poverty. Workers know that it is tougher to send their child to school and to pay the house note. That's where most people live, and that's why the recent election was a major referendum on economics. 6 years later, 10% of our society owns 70% of the wealth. 90% owns 30%. The top 40% of our workers earn 68% of the income. They got a tax cut. The bottom 40% make 15.7%. They got a wage cut and a plant closing and chastisement. 6 years later, the number of our youth in jails have increased and colleges have decreased. 25 billionaires up top, 14 more since last year, 3 million homeless at the bottom. Lest we forget, these radical economic extremes, this radical economic polarization is classic Reaganomics. For us, who are Democrats, the issue, therefore, is more than party control. It's party direction. After all, the Democrats have had control of the House all alone. They still supported Mr. Reagan's unfair budget and tax cuts, Contra aid, aid to UNITA, Graham Rutland Hollins, hog butcher, immoral, illegal legislation, the unprecedented and unnecessary military buildup in peacetime. They've done little to cut the budget deficit, the trade deficit, the national debt. The people are crying out for a new direction, and that's what the Rainbow Coalition represents. Justice and humane priorities at home, peace through human rights, and negotiations abroad. The Democratic control in the Senate is nothing more than an opportunity to provide a clear alternative to Reaganism and Reaganomics. Democrats must bring in the morning, not just declare the sun is setting. We must bring in the morning. We must go in a new direction. What difference does it make if the wagon is pulled by an elephant or a donkey, if both are chauffeur driven, have the same values and going in the same direction? We need more than a change of parties. There must be a change fundamentally in direction. We cannot simply imitate Reagan. We cannot succeed with our hair going to the left like Kennedy and our behavior going to the right like Reagan. We must be clear in our thrust. Do not blow a trumpet with an uncertain sound. If we go the way of imitation, The people go for the real thing rather than an imitation. So we have been intimidated by Reagan. If so, we imitate him. We vote for contra aid in an attempt to overthrow a government with which we have diplomatic relations, support the invasion of Grenada, oppose strong economic sanctions against South Africa, oppose developmental aid, we engage in killing in El Salvador, oppose a freeze on nuclear testing, the no first use policy, vote for aid to UNITA in Angola and the rebels in Mozambique, do not hold the president responsible for a disinformation campaign in Libya, and allow him to change a foreign policy illegally in Iran. Then what progress have we made? If we stand in that line, none. If control of the Senate by Democrats does not mean policies that address the basic maldistribution of income and wealth in the country, if it does not provide health coverage for the 35 million wallowing in poverty, if it does not make serious progress on the budget deficit, the national debt and trade imbalance, if it does not do anything for the 7% or 8 to 9 million people unemployed, if it does not repudiate Graham Rutman Hollins and assure and assume the responsibility of making decisions that we were elected to make, if we do not reform the tax code, then we have not made the difference that we could make. We must chart a new course. In fact, embrace this new coalition. After all, when you combine all of these who have been rejected by Reaganism and Reaganomics, that is the majority of the American people. We must represent alternative programs and policies that represent the interests of the masses, not just the classes. We must make enforcement of the Voting Rights Act our number one priority. After all, it was the Voting Rights Act of 65 that made the victories in November of 86 possible. The Voting Rights Act is not being enforced. It is the key to inclusion, mass participation, and progressive politics in this country. This black vote is not an isolated, enigmatic vote. It's a trigger vote for the progressive coalition. It's a mainstream vote. When blacks vote in great numbers, Latinos win. Our interests converge. When blacks and Latinos vote in great numbers, women win. They're mostly female. When blacks, Latinos, and women vote in great numbers, workers win. Blacks, Latinos, and women are mostly workers. When blacks and Latinos and women and workers win, the poor are helped because you're mostly poor. And so this black vote is not some enigma, some inexplicable phenomenon. It's the trigger vote to the progressive coalition in our country. Voting Rights Act is our number one priority. It is that which empowers us to be a part of this dynamic process. We must put jobs and full employment back at the center stage of our domestic economic agenda. We must put America back to work as an alternative to welfare and despair. That must be our battle cry. We must stop redlining inner city USA while we green line South Africa. Invest in rebuilding urban America. Take these youth whose spirits have been crushed, these buoyant, beautiful grapes of human potentiality that have been reduced to dried and bitter raisins. Let them have hope again. Train them to turn the slummy side into the sunny side. Put skills in their hands, information in their head. Give them hope for a bright tomorrow. We must bring in the morning. We must have a comprehensive universal healthcare system. Many Americans tonight are dying in emergency rooms because they don't have a green or yellow card to go upstairs to a bed, empty, waiting for the rich to get sick. Most poor people are not on welfare. Most poor people are not black. Most poor people work every day. And when they get to work and they're still poor, who are these poor people? They are farmers. Maybe the hardest working, most risk-taking Americans. Who are these poor people? They drive cabs. They rob, threaten, and harass. They keep on working. Who are these poor people? They sweep streets. They catch the early bus in the morning before the poll takers wake up. Who are these poor people? They change beds in hotels every day. Who are these poor people? They mop halls in hospitals. They change the clothes and the beds of the feverishly sick. And when they get sick, they cannot afford to lie in those beds. Who are these poor people? They're the ones whose sons are the first to die in the war, the last to reap benefits in peace. A great nation must measure its character not just by what it accumulates, but by what it shares. Our character is still measured by how we treat the least of these, the children, yes, in the dawn of life. Obstructed genius that never has a chance to blossom. The poor in the pit of life. The old people in the sunset of life. The stranger on the Jericho Road. Our nation must have a comprehensive healthcare system. An educational system that makes room for the locked out. Illiteracy costs more than literacy. Ignorance costs more than intelligence. A diseased body costs more than a healthy body. Incarceration more than education. Any state public education in our country for 4 years, a full-time scholarship, less than $30,000. Full four-year penitentiary scholarship, $110,000 to $146,000. Penitentiaries cost 5 to 7 times more than universities. Morally sound, economically correct. We must provide housing for the homeless. 3 million homeless people in our society, not just derelicts. People working every day in New York, thousands living in welfare hotels, paying up to $2,000 every 2 weeks for a room, a common cafeteria downstairs, up to $4,000 a month to stay in a room. State, federal equation. There's so much contempt for the poor. They cannot use that money for homesteading. Cannot use that money to train their youth to take over vacant houses and have habitable places in which to live. We must bring in the morning. We must fight a war on poverty, ignorance and disease, and win. The Democratic Party has a great chance and a great choice. The fact is, when we accumulate the locked out, we are the new majority. We have the power, if we have the will and the courage to take our nation on a higher plane. Lastly, I just left Southern Africa. It's clear that our nation's non-policy in the region is a policy, in fact, of non-interference with South Africa's hegemony in the region. South Africa, as of September 27th, has shifted its policy from internal cosmetic changes like interracial marriage, lifting of past books. They now face north. The new plan is threefold. make Mozambique ungovernable, repatriate workers from the south, launch an attack from Malawi to the north, divide Mozambique north and south, as in Vietnam and Korea, along the Zambezi River, control the Barra Corridor, landlock Zimbabwe and Zambia. Make Mozambique ungovernable, engage in military aggression, economic destabilization. South Africa has now expanded its resistance to justice. It reacted to the American sanctions by imposing punishment on frontline neighbors. Our weakened sanctions must be accompanied by commitment, indeed, $1 billion commitment as an investment to redevelop trade routes through Nacala, Maputo, and Barra, that southern African countries might have alternative trade routes. They need security, the ability to defend themselves from constant South African invasion. The frontline states in southern Africa need the same thing that the frontline states in Western Europe needed 45 years ago. Summit meeting with leadership, sanctions, long-term economic development, emergency aid, and defense. Frontline states in southern Africa need no less. Summit meeting with leadership, sanctions against fascist apartheid, historical successor to Hitler and Nazi Germany. No nation, no individual can trade with South Africa, sell arms to South Africa, maintain its moral authority and credibility at the same time. To trade with South Africa is to trade with Hitler's successor. To give comfort to South Africa, to give comfort to Nazism. Our nation is much too great, has much to offer Africa and the world to wallow in such filthy and immoral quagmire. Your generation must challenge this university, must challenge corporations with whom you come in contact. It's time for another way. It's a new day. I suppose the supreme challenge of your generation is to come alive. You have powers that no previous generation ever had. You have the power of a massive vote, the powers of developed minds, marching feet, and dollars. You must come alive. You must not allow this administration to anesthetize your conscience and blow your mind. There is no world market for yuppies. There is no world market for buppies or luppies. There is no human need to be fulfilled by such selfish materialism without some sense of spiritual balance. Oh, I'm realistic enough to know that we cannot be mindlessly materialistic. We must balance it off with some being, some notion of materialistic mindedness. We need the basics, but then we need not be greedy. We cannot walk around without the sense of responsibility when 10 years ago, University of Chicago had 5% black students. Today it's 2.5% and dropping. 1,300 faculty members, 11 black and dropping. Harvard, 97 black freshmen, down 30% in 10 years. University of Michigan, 7.7% black students in 1976, 5.0 today, and dropping, except in the athletic department where we are magnets to make millions and build the careers of coaches. Princeton, 645 faculty members, 7 are black, down. 1,600 graduate students, 22 are black, down. Your generation must fight apartheid without and apartheid within. And so, our challenge is to be just, to fight terrorism all over the world and at home. By one yardstick, fight for human rights all over the world and at home. By one yardstick, to do justice, love mercy, and walk on before our God, have a spiritual foundation. How can we be trapped with a $150 billion a year drug habit? How can we be a great nation, picturing our brains in liquor, blowing coke in our membrane? Sex without love making unwanted and unhealthy babies. And so temperamental that the flash of a hat kills somebody. A great nation must have at its foundation great and strong people who must choose to be sober, sane and sensitive and sincere. Oh, the media focuses on inner city teenage children and drugs. They just don't have $150 billion a year. When we look for drug trafficking in the ghetto or barrio, try Battery Park below Wall Street overlooking the Statue of Liberty. Try the doctor, so says the American Medical Association. Try the judges. Try the pulpits. Face this epidemic and do something about it. Have a sense of justice, but also a sense of mercy. If somebody has a drug problem in their lives, lock them up is not an instant solution. Mayor Clark said to me a few months ago that we've arrested 55,000 drug pushers in 2 years. 4,000 are arrested. There is no room for the other 51,000. These drug victims are not mostly mean, they're mostly sick. But whether sick or mean, they're mostly ours, our parents, our classmates, our friends, our children. Leadership must be willing to fight without, but bear the burdens of pain and change within. My wife and I have 5 children. I said to our 2 daughters, the reason's quite obvious. Don't get pregnant before you're prepared to get married and have a balanced family. But if you do, you're still our daughter. And those are our grandchildren. There's room for you in our heart, even a hurting heart. So boys, say no to drugs, because taking drugs is morally wrong and physically destructive and life-threatening. If by chance you get trapped in one of the hazards of your environment, don't go further in the hole. You still have a home to come to. There is some compassion, some mercy blended with our sense of justice. Whatever we say about the drug crisis, the people trap the drugs in their bloodstream, they must get well. But your generation must accept this as one of the maladies of your day and one of the challenges of this hour. And so, stand tall, young America. Your challenges are great. Your equipment is sufficient. Stand tall. Do noble work. Do not negotiate away your dream for the real world of beauty. Your generation can wipe out malnutrition. Your generation can make medicine available for all the sick of our nation. Your generation can do justice in America and bring peace in the world. It's your challenge, it's your chance, it's your choice. Thank you very much.
We'll take questions from alternating mics on each side.
Reverend Jackson, you have the following of millions of Americans. You're perhaps the one widely respected leader in the nation who has the capacity to marshal major and effective public opposition to the current nuclear escalation between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Given that 1987 appears to be a critical year, offering perhaps unprecedented opportunities for large arms reduction, and given the insane and monstrous Star Wars program, which has become the major obstacle to such reduction, would you consider issuing a call to the concerned people of America to come to Washington for a determined massive campaign to put an end to Star Wars? Would you lead such a campaign to scrap Star Wars in favor of a reordering of our national priorities so that the real needs of human beings could be met? As a Christian pastor on a study fellowship here at Harvard, I know that I'm just one of thousands of pastors across the nation who would greatly welcome such prestigious and effective leadership in such a critical area. And I'm confident that we, along with countless others across the land, could help raise up a huge grassroots following. So the question is, have you considered or would you consider leading such a campaign?
Well, let me express at the outset that I identify with your position. The Star Wars is a misplaced priority. It's a nightmare for the heavens. It is a trigger to arms escalation. This abstract but dangerous concept has made some people feel secure because the president says it scares the Russians. It may frighten them, but not into paralysis. It frightens them into stimulation to develop weapons to overshoot it or overwhelm it. And that's what escalation is all about in the first place. I would be interested in being a part of such a call. It must be perceived as a broad-based resistance movement across lines to be really effective. We've taken a position all along that the nuclear arms race is too dangerous, it's too costly, it's too likely to take place. Mr. Reagan missed an excellent opportunity in Iceland to make a significant step to reduce the arms and tensions in this world. So now we have a kind of momentum coming out of the 86 elections. And so I'm convinced that by the spring of 87, that a massive movement to reorder national priorities, not the least of which is to scrap Star Wars and move toward a more reasonable approach to arms reduction is what we should do. So when this meeting is over, I would like to talk to you a few minutes because we perhaps can follow up. Reverend Jack Mendelson is here in the audience and other people who are of the same persuasion that you've expressed, and perhaps we can hook in Sane and other groups after this and expand the idea.
Thank you very much.
Before the next question, we have these cultural differences. Now, some of you who live in Boston and north of Boston, you are excited about that cold air coming in here. I ain't. First, I thought that Harvard was just too cheap to provide heat. And then it occurs to me that some of you just figured an alternative to falling asleep on a lecture was to stay awake by avoiding freezing to death. So please let some of those windows down if you don't mind. Please. I mean, as in now.
Reverend Jackson, I
agree with the heart of your message that there is definitely a need for a new direction in the Democratic Party to pick up on a broad spectrum of dissatisfaction with Reaganism policies. What I'm wondering is, how much is the leadership of the Democratic Party, including you, who seem to represent many of the ideals of this broad dissatisfaction, within the dialogue of shaping the role that the party is going to take in these next 2 years, which are to be crucial? And if I might just sort of add an additional question, that if have you set for yourself a timetable within which you will decide whether or not the party is responding to what you see as a call out there for a new direction, and if not, when you would consider perhaps announcing your own plans as to 1988.
You've touched the real point of tension in the party. There has been tremendous intimidation by Reagan upon many leaders, and therefore the flattery that you give to the conqueror is imitation. And so Rehnquist would not have been the Chief Justice had not many Democrats voted for him. Graham Roman Hollins would not have passed without 21 Democratic votes. The $100 million Contra aid would not have passed without Democratic votes. And so there is this challenge to define the party along lines that are that have some ideological coherence and represent direction. I've had tremendous struggles within the party the last 2 years, because in 1984, 45% of my voters were disenfranchised, and we lost 400 delegates in the process. The agreement was to form a fairness commission that Maynard Jackson would be chairman of, and then compromise Dutch Morial. But then finally, they decided to wipe us out of the fairness commission. And thus the fairness commission was not fair at all, because it did not involve meaningfully the affected people. A policy commission. We were locked out of the policy commission dialogue. The result is no strong statement on a commitment to an economic rights amendment for women, a plant closing legislation, a voter rights enforcement, a comprehensive plan to end apartheid in Southern Africa. And that's a point of challenge. That was a Democratic fundraiser a month ago. And they invited all past and prospective candidates to the fundraiser. And I was not invited to the fundraiser. And so there are these blatant attempts to reject our point of view and our constituency. So at this point, it's real tension. There are a host of Democrats who represent the persuasion I've expressed tonight, who are not a part of the ruling elite that choose control over winning. They're those who would choose to control the party and lock out the masses, or at best use them for limited purposes. And so I will determine, perhaps by the spring of this year, as to what plans I will pursue in the context of the Rainbow Coalition for 1988. We're going to have a board meeting later on this month to analyze these elections. But in the meantime, we have continued to build constituency groups in the Rainbow Coalition and keep that pressure alive. There are far more advantages now in seizing the concern of historical Democrats and new Democrats than breaking out. At this point, I choose to fight rather than switch. I choose to get the attention, the party, and the nation. Just how much resistance this drive for a new direction will realize is difficult to tell. It's a kind of day-by-day struggle. But I'm tough. I'm not afraid. We're going to hang on in there and make a difference.
Thank you.
Reverend Jackson, you criticized President Reagan for his negotiating with the terrorist regime in Iran, and yet one of your supporters, Louis Farrakhan, has ties with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Are you prepared to repudiate Louis Farrakhan and to ask him to withdraw his relationship with Colonel Muammar Gaddafi?
To compare President Reagan's authority and responsibility with Farrakhan is a poor equation, number one. Number two, I can disagree with Farrakhan's position or Reagan's position without repudiating either. That's such exaggerated language, and it does not lend itself to solving problems. I do not agree with Gaddafi's politics, and therefore I do not have a relationship with him. Apparently, Armin Hammer does agree with his politics. He has business dealings with him. And Farrakhan does. He has business dealings with him. But those are their choice. I choose to repudiate neither. It's just the option. I choose to go another way. In the context of the Iranian situation, and American hostages who are prisoners of war in that situation, to give expensive arms and equipment in exchange for hostages raises the value on the lives of the hostages, which endangers them. So you cannot compare some relationship between any private citizen and Gaddafi and the impact and ramifications of this government, of this administration, violating official government policy and endangering the lives of all who live in the Middle East. It's just no sound comparison.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir, we've heard a lot about 1988 tonight. What not a lot of people are talking about is 1991. Both major parties have begun to target the state legislatures in an attempt to take over the reapportionment process. What is your organization, what is the Rainbow Coalition doing, what can they do in order to have a greater influence following the 1990 census?
Well, we certainly know that the reapportionment struggles that will take place and culminate in 1990 will have impact far into the next century. Our day-to-day work in 86 and 88 determined that we have people in those legislatures to protect the interests of the historical disenfranchised. Now, we cannot leap over 88 to get to 90. And so the moves that we made last week to get a more sensitive Senate, a more sensitive Congress, and protect very valuable state legislators is our move in the direction of being prepared for that great showdown, which will take place in 1990 and 1992.
Reverend Jackson, you mentioned your trip to South Africa, and I was concerned. Why was there so little press coverage on the trip?
Well, because the press basically is insensitive to South Africa and Southern Africa. I talked with a major political analyst, perhaps the most major, in Washington about a month ago to give a report on our trip in August. He said, what you are saying is sound. I like the way it sounds, but I don't make a habit of covering leaders with whom I have not met and places I have never been. I have never been to Southern Africa. I said, it's a good admission, but it's also a shame. President Reagan has not been to Southern Africa. Bush, Kemp, Hart, Gephardt, Biden, none of them have been. And because the leaders have not been, and the writers have not written, we still basically have a Tarzan policy toward Africa. And in our ignorance and our glorification of Tarzan, we been on the wrong side of every struggle, in Nkrumah and Ghana down to Mugabe and Zimbabwe. We must keep challenging the press and the leaders to go there. To go to Michelle's funeral, where leaders from around the world were there, heads of state, and only Maureen Reagan there from the White House, which was a courteous expression, but not a foreign policy official, further reflects our hands-off policy toward the region. It allowed President Reagan to say at a press conference in the middle of August, as I said earlier tonight, the difference between South Africa and the Sandinistas is the Sandinistas go beyond their borders, South Africa does not. Southern Angola is 2,000 miles from the Cape, as far as New York to Denver. Cabinda, where the South Africans tried to blow up, Northern Angola is as far from New York to California, 3,000 miles. When Mr. Ford made this mistake relative to Poland some years ago, because the press has a greater sense of Europe, it jumped and declared he was unfit to be president because he didn't understand this big global issue in Poland. When Reagan said it about Southern Africa, since he didn't know what he was talking about, and the press didn't either, ignorance was bliss, and they just danced on off into the sunset. You know, the Chicago press didn't know, and Reagan didn't know, and they just had big fun washing the ignorance. What's painful to me is that I know, and you must know, that South Africa is not only holding blacks in subjugation, it's also holding Western industries hostage. For so long as South Africa maintains monopoly and hegemony on the region, then all of us must pay through our noses to get to the other southern states. It's not in America's moral or economic interest to allow fascist South Africa to stay and exist as it is. South Africans are going to win that struggle. It's not a matter of whether but when. It would make morally correct and future planning sense to be on the right side of history. It has been difficult to get the press to cover the circumstantial evidence around South Africa's involvement in Michelle's killing. Several facts. One, defense minister threatened Michelle 2 weeks before the plane went down. September 27, South Africa launched an attack, a new attack, dividing Mozambique, military aggression, economic destabilization. Plane left, it was monitored all the way, as all presidential planes are. The two routes were submitted. Neither involved going west over South Africa. In case of trouble, go east over the Indian Ocean. South Africa in contact with the plane until 9:25, it went down at 9:30. They said they know that it crashed. They let Mozambique know the next morning at 6:50, 9 hours later. They then sent them to the wrong place. Therefore, they got to the plane at 10:50 the next morning, 12 and a half hours later. They said they know Michelle was on the plane. Eyewitnesses now report that when they got there, many people still alive. They didn't die from the crash, but from shock and bleeding. Villagers were there. The police ran them away. They walked over crying and dying bodies, looking for papers and money. To suggest that South Africa did not know that plane was in the country is to suggest that a plane could get into South Africa and stay 9 hours with bombs and not be known that it exists. And yet, rather than deal with the fact that the plane went down in Mozambique and they have not given up the pilot's recorder's box yet, South Africa now said, yes, we got the papers and we found out that they were trying to overthrow Malawi. Malawi is allowing troops to be launched to overthrow Mozambique. So it's not surprising that you would find plans in Malawi to overthrow Mozambique or vice versa because they are fighting. What does that have to do with South Africa using beams to divert that flight pattern into that mountain? The American press knows this. They've not investigated it vigorously. And so that's part of the burden of trying to change a nation, however slow and begrudgingly. We do know that if, in fact, a European head of state had fallen into East Berlin, no stone would have been unturned until the facts were exposed. That's the double standard, and that's the rub.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First of all, let me begin by saying, Reverend Jackson, that this is the first time I've had the opportunity to hear you speak, and I found your words very inspiring.
But thank you.
The thrust of my question is this. In the past, the thrust of your politics has been as a voice of the poor and oppressed, the despised and the rejected, the locked out. And if nothing else, your presidential candidacy in 84 proved that poor people in and of themselves cannot elect a national candidate. And so if you do indeed intend to seek national office, particularly as president in 1988, to what extent do you think it might become necessary to compromise the views of the poor to accommodate the interests of those who can elect a national candidate?
It does not disprove the power of the poor in national politics. Kennedy won over Nixon by 112,000 votes in 1960. Many credit his gesture to help get Dr. King out of jail in Albany, Georgia, with being the difference between people voting for a relatively unknown Kennedy and an 8-year vice president, Richard Nixon. The poor, therefore, have power, and in close elections are the margin. In 1976, well, in 68, Nixon beat Humphrey by 550,000. He won by the margin of the diminished enthusiasm of the poor. Robert Kennedy dead, Dr. King dead, the Republicans running a no-vote campaign exploding despair. The absence of the poor vote elected Nixon. 76, Carter beat Ford by 1.8 million. It was an inspired vote of the poor that made the difference. Just as the earlier data I shared with you tonight was a difference in these congressional and senatorial campaigns last Tuesday. No one group can elect the president. Some small groups try to select the president, but the masses still have the option to do the electing. And so we need coalition. We can mobilize a majority coalition if those constituents believe. The nation's 53% female. You add the rejected women whose drive for equity is being diminished, and blacks and Latinos and busted workers and busted labor unions and workers with wage concessions, and youth who desire and need peace, the locked out of the new majority. We have the power in coalition to redirect the course of our nation. No one group can do it. And that's why you have to have a coalition where we turn on each other, not to each other, and use our converging interests to put forth a new agenda. Last week, the blacks and the whites and the Latinos together won those new seats. The converging interest did it. And that's my basic premise on your response, is that when the poor don't vote, they tend to, by default, have those elected who are insensitive to them. When the poor rise up with righteous indignation and use that vote, they almost always win. One of the great disappointments to me in my lifetime is that youth, young America, most of you in this room tonight are not registered to vote. And that's a source of great pain to me. Well, since we're in this kind of setting, in this holy room, how many of you are not registered to vote? Be honest and stay in school. You are not registered to vote. Raise your hand. Just stand up, please. You're not by yourself. Stand up. You are not registered to vote. Please stand. Please. If you lie, you're going to flunk your law exam. Stand up. Keep standing. Get them up. Some of y'all, I know you're ashamed. Keep on standing. Get up. Well, thank you very much. This is the courageous margin. Give them a hand. My point is that to have 3.1 million high school seniors, 90% unregistered but eligible, to have 11 million college students eligible, about 25% registered, that's one of the great national disservices of all time. So yeah, if the students and the poor and the locked out and the concerned vote, we can determine the course of our country.
Thank you.
Before you get the last question, February 20th, 1987, the Underground Railroad tripped to D.C. to protest South African embassy en masse, sponsored the Harvard Black Law Students in conjunction with TransAfrica. When people are leaving tonight, they can register for the trip downstairs. Nominal fee, about $5, only $5, that's emphasis. Underground Railroad. Right.
I was wondering, how is the Rainbow Coalition going to pursue its agenda in such a way to avoid the kind of backlash that would jeopardize needed reform? And I mean, will there be certain tactical changes so interest groups won't have to go to the media and make demands and then later make the candidate appear to be capitulating to their interests? Is there going to be some kind of change so the kind of a repeat of 1984 doesn't come about?
You know, I've heard a lot about those demands being stated, and the candidate had to appear to be weak. No time soon will business stop asserting quite publicly to Fortune magazine and Wall Street Journal its interests. No time soon will labor stop having conventions asserting its interests. Our university presidents stop having conferences and press conferences asserting their interests. Every group in the country that has an interest has a right to express the interest. Now, if you have strong interest and weak leadership, don't fault the interest. Strong leadership must reconcile the converging interests. Because when Latinos are concerned about immigration policy, they should not be asked to vote by night and hide by day. That's disrespectful. Blacks who are sensitive to their civil rights being violated should not be asked to vote by night and dodge by day. Women should not be asked to wait in the background. You know, we gave y'all a chance in 84, but y'all got to wait. Why should 53% of the population wait another day? Why? What's all that about? It just seems to me that farmers and women and environmentalists and peace activists and blacks and whites and workers and trade unionists must assert themselves and then choose leadership that can, without apology, link those interests into a harmonious network. So American life is not a blanket, all one piece of uncut cloth, red or white or blue, that's kind of simply put. America is more like a quilt, many patches, all of which are valid, and pieces, and colors, and sizes. And great leadership takes a common thread and weaves those interests together. And that's a thing of beauty. It's a thing of power. It's the formula for national championship in November of '88. Thank you very much.